Thank you, Grant. We're just about to embark on a short trilogy of sermons in Advent, and in which will be myself this week, Fiona next week, and myself again the week after, around the theme of the dawn from on high. We're going to look at that passage we just heard from Zechariah's song. In fact, we're just going to look at the final verses from 76 to 79 and reflect on those. As we do so, Fiona and I read a from the great group called Common Grace, have an Advent series that you can receive by email or by posting on their webpage. Well worth looking at, Common Grace. And there's a quite striking one as part of their Advent series, so much so that I said, I've got to use that for my sermon. And Fiona said, well, I was going to use it for my sermon next week. So we've agreed to share it as it goes. Listen to these words, initially a reflection on Genesis 1. The rolling polycrisis of our times ravages our spirits. Injustice reaving our systems. The ongoing devastation of family violence. War and conflict burning up our feeds. The continued, even devilishly gleeful, plundering of our common home. We're waiting for a new world to be born. But waiting doesn't even begin to describe it. The word seems too neutral, passive. We wait for a train. But the waiting I mean is more an agony of longing, one that drives prayerful action, difficult conversations to shift the dial, faithful tending of the gardens within our reach, patient endurance to keep going despite encouragement. And just skipping down a little bit more before it. Then Advent arrives, the season that gives us heart to keep waiting. It gives us the courage to fully stare into the void because we know that the true light that gives light to all humankind is coming, indeed has come and will come again into the world. God sends the baby Jesus. Love breaks through the way light breaks through the darkness. It may seem frail, a flickering hope, but all is changed. Isn't it powerful? If you'd like a copy of that, we can copy off some afterwards after the service. So as we go through this Advent season and stop and pause, we're just going to focus on these final few verses of Zechariah's song. Today I'm going to focus on the phrase around the knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of sins. Next week, Fiona's going to pick up the next verse talking about how God's tender mercy breaks through, like the dawn breaks upon us from high. And then I'll come back and look at how the way of peace, those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. So that's our plan for the next few weeks. We have been focusing on our series for the last couple of months, almost 2.5 months, on shining as lights in a troubled world, how God can use us to be a shining light. And the image I had is of darkness and some lights just flickering away in different directions. And we come to Advent, it's not so much that we are those flickering lights, we now anticipate this great daybreak emerging upon us. The true light comes and breaks into our world. So something at the background of this song, this portion of Luke's gospel, it's only in Luke, it has that period where Zechariah, who was to become the father of John the Baptist, serving as a priest before God, and he was on duty in the temple, chosen by lot. And so he went into the holy place of the Lord to burn incense. And while he was there, the angel Gabriel spoke to him and said, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. The faithful prayers of those people waiting for this deliverance of the promises that God had made. And your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will name him John. Joy and gladness will come to you. And many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the sight of God. Now, you might recall this is actually not an unfamiliar pattern where God brings extraordinary people to mothers in particular who say, "You've got to be joking." Zechariah said to the Lord, "How can I be sure of this? For I'm an old man and my wife is old as well." The angel answered him, "I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you, to bring you the good news. And now, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time, you will be silent, unable to speak until the day these things take place." That's the background. Now, there's been all sorts of speculation of what a gift that was to Elizabeth during her pregnancy. Didn't have a husband fussing over her or trying to direct her in all different directions. But anyway, when the moment came for the naming of John the Baptist, he indeed had him named John, as indicated, and then he was able to speak. And so we come to the song that Zechariah then is able to give expression to, his understanding of why this is indeed cause for hope. First of all, a little bit of background behind the expectation, the hopes. What were the prayers that Zechariah and Elizabeth, and we know others, have been offering daily in the temple? What were they praying for? Well, the background goes back to the hopes that came through the prophets, especially through Isaiah. Some of you, I was actually speaking to someone in the past week who was saying that they had been part of a community choir singing Handel's Messiah in the past week or so. I know Clayton Wesley, I think, had it organised as well. And he was saying how he'd done it with his son, and it was just so moving to see sing the words of Handel's Messiah that carries you through. And if you know Handel's Messiah, the opening words, I think it's sung by a tenor, someone could correct me otherwise, but there's a solo that has these haunting words, "Comfort, comfort my people, says the Lord." God says, the time has come. Now, the background of that prophetic thing is that Israel had gone through the horrific experience of being defeated by the Babylonians, of Jerusalem being destroyed and taken into captivity into Babylon for decades, 70 years. And in that time, they were pressed to try and not give up their hopes that their faith in God had been defeated. And then the words of Isaiah came, "Speak kindly to Jerusalem." This is the people who had formerly been in Jerusalem, were now in captivity way over in Babylon, saying that the time of her warfare is over, that her punishment is completed. The prophet said, why did this happen? It actually happened because you ignored God. You didn't listen to him. You did your own thing as a nation. And despite the warnings of the prophets, you continued to do so. So God used the Babylonians to remove them from Jerusalem. But God said, now enough. The time has come. And then we have this beautiful image. Now, we often think of the Romans as great road builders, and they were seriously good road builders. Some of the Roman roads still exist today. But also, what's less known is that the Persians were great road builders. And in particular, one of the roads is the Royal Road, built by Darius I of Persia, around 500 BC, around the time of Isaiah, which was over 1,600 miles long, a significant road. And when they knew that a monarch was going to come, they would make sure that the roads are good and straight so the king and all his entourage and most likely his army can move through. So that is the image that Isaiah picks up. Prepare the way of the Lord, make a straight road for our God in the desert, because our God is coming in triumph as a king, as a sovereign. But it was never fully fulfilled. Yes, they returned to Jerusalem. Yes, they were able to rebuild the walls. Yes, they were able to rebuild a poor imitation of what had been Solomon's temple, and they were still continuing to do it. But the king had never returned to Jerusalem. And even in the time of Jesus, under Roman occupation, their prayers was, Lord, will you send your promised one who will come as king, and we can be your people, and he will enter the holy city. That was their hope. That was their prayer. And that is what Zechariah understood through Gabriel's message. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, speaking over the baby John the Baptist, the cousin of Jesus. For you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give his people knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins. Now, the sins were personal, but in particular, this is a whole civic sense of sin, the whole people who had gone the wrong way as a community. This is judgment was brought upon the people of Israel because from the leadership right through, they were not listening to God and had gone their own way and entered into other treaties and other things to try and secure themselves. This, the assurance of forgiveness is both personal and it is communal. And this would occur when the one who follows the prophet comes. Which brings us to a word that's actually rather fallen out of favour these days, the word sin. In many ways, sin has been trivialised. In fact, it's even commercialised. You have sinful chocolate, something that's a guilty pleasure. Sin City, treat yourself, you deserve it. So it's actually said as though this is something that is highly commendable and can be sort of said with a smile on the face. Sin has been trivialised. Many people perceive sin as an old religious concept that's no longer relevant to modern life. It's hard as an academic at times or in other areas to talk about sin. It has been associated with institutional religion, with moralizing, and of guilt culture, making people feel bad constantly, week in, week out. Some review it as a term that belongs more to history, a museum piece of the church or literature, rather than modern everyday ethics. So what are we to make of this? In one summary term, you might say that people would come back and say, oh, we don't talk about sin anymore, we talk about choices. Or that lovely term that educationists and parents and others talk about, consequences. You make a choice, there are consequences. We talk about unhealthy behaviour, we talk about harm, trauma, about illness, about psychology. And there's elements of truth in all that. I do not for a moment want to undermine, say, like, that is rubbish. It's not rubbish, but it's not the whole truth. We need to recognise that though the language of sin is gone, many people still have a strong sense of moral seriousness, but use different language to describe it. So we shouldn't be despairing and saying, well, because people don't use the language sin, the whole notion has been thrown out. There is still a strong sense of accountability of what is right and what is wrong. People can come out of court and say, that wasn't right, that wasn't just, that wasn't fair. And we don't challenge that as saying we shouldn't be talking about justice and not right and fair. We still do have that sense. We just don't tend to use the language of sin to describe it. Now, this is going to be an illustration that's going to reveal very much my age and generation. I'm a child of the 70s. I studied philosophy at university in the 1970s. It was a particularly bleak period to study philosophy. The most that our lecturers at the end of the day could come up with is, I think, therefore I am, maybe. You know, which is not a really enthusiastic rationale for life. So most of my years, as my generation tended to do, got more out of the bands that I followed rather than out of my university lectures. I learned about education from Pink Floyd. Certain song about another brick in the wall, which my generation really got into. It motivated my brother to get into teaching education. He said that right. And my philosophy of life was shaped by another band which I particularly like, Supertramp. Anyone familiar with Supertramp? Like, I actually got it out again. John loved it, so I played it in the car, and it's been ringing in my ears all week. I have this earworm of Supertramp, and this song in particular. Supertramp. Who knew that they were great philosophers? Their album, Crime of the Century, had these lyrics. This is the words of their song, of this the song. The Crime of the Century. They're planning the crime of the century. Well, what would it be? Read all about their schemes and adventuring. Yes, it's well worth the fee. Yes, come and observe these great criminals. So roll up and see how they rape the universe, how they've gone from bad to worse. Who are these men of lust, greed, and glory? Rip off the masks and let's see. So roll up and see how they rape the universe and how they've gone from bad to worse. And then the line that really strikes. But that's not right. I know. What's the story? Look, there's you. And there's me. That can't be right. They recognise that when we talk about moral accountability, we can't just rail about everyone else without recognising we are part of that story. Told you it was good philosophy, wasn't it? Even not bad theology too, for that matter. I won't play it to you because you have your ringing in your ears all week. It just stays there as well. There is that sense that all was not right with the world. In fact, it would be a very rare person if anyone was in hands out, look, the world is just hunky-dory. We know things are not right, and we know that we all need to take some responsibility for it in differing ways. So where do we go with that? Well, I'm encouraged that there is still a strong moral consciousness around. People don't just speak against, but actually feel passionate about accounts of oppression, of racism, of environmental destruction, about the abuse of power, of economic injustice, about child abuse, about sexual exploitation. There is that strong sense that we need to name and address and do something about these things. So these are widely acknowledged as serious wrongs, but they are typically described in secular moral political terms rather than coming out of a sin about something that is inherent within us. So where do we go with some biblical reflections on sin over against this background? We want to honour the recognition that there is a concern for justice. People haven't abandoned a sense of right and wrong. But where does our understanding of biblical notions sit within it? There's a lot more that could be said from this, but let's just touch on a few of them. First of all, the Bible says sin is deadly serious. It is not light entertainment. Set aside those caricatures and the folly of trivialising it as though that's where the fun is in life. The Bible affirms that it is dangerous. Sin is essentially relational, not a performance checklist of things that we may or may not have done that are wrong or shouldn't have done, all those types of things. It may result in that, but the illustration I've used a number of times, some of you may have heard it, me use it before as well. Imagine when you bring up a child and you care for the child and you go through the sleepless nights and you do all the hard work of caring for a child, and then the child gets to a time in which they fall over in a playground, raise their knee, and they come back and want to receive some love, and you offer that love. And they get to teenage years, and suddenly they become particularly attentive to you when you want, when they want something. You know, want some cash or use of a car or whatever else. They get to that age when you ask them to do something around the house, and they either just ignore you, or they do what most teenagers do as an art form. They say, yeah, and then ignore you. How do you feel at that moment? You feel angry. This is not fair. This is not right. I've put all this care and love into you, and now you're taking me for granted. You're just thinking, I'm here to do your washing. I'm here to do all these things. Yet that is exactly how every one of us treats God. God, who created us, formed us, nurtures us, provides for us, yet I would suspect none of us will say, I don't take God for granted. I don't go to God whenever I had a need when I've scraped my knee, when I'm trying to find a parking spot or whatever it may be. We take God for granted. And that is not right. And it's not just a shame. This is actually a sin of our relationship with God. It breaks the relationship. We can even take God in a sense of blaming God for everything without taking responsibility ourselves in that space. Sin is essentially that relational element of ignoring God, taking God for granted, and just doing our own thing. It's also true that sin has been used to shame and to control. It is a very powerful dynamic, and leaders, spiritual leaders, leaders who teach in the church, need to be very careful about not just bringing that brush of sin to make put people down in their place. Because God's purpose is to raise us up. He doesn't brush it under the carpet, but he follows it with what we're going to hear next week from Fiona, with an assurance of God's tender mercy. He says, we can deal with this, and I want you to stand, and I want you to grow, and let's move on. It is never used as a power dynamic to control or to manipulate or keep people in their place. So we need to recognize that is a danger, and there is such a thing as a guilt culture. We can also affirm that people haven't really lost the reality of sin, only the language to name it and the hope to deal with it. So maybe put it this way as a summary of some of those things. I would suggest that our contemporary perceptions about justice, what is right and what is wrong, what we need to change, what is not good enough, focus on the symptoms. But what the Bible contributes is a theology that names the disease, that gets to the heart of what makes us who we are, why we choose what we do, why we find ourselves entering into, both personal or communally, into behaviour that suddenly becomes acceptable when a generation ago would say otherwise. So I'm going to have a very brief splash around the deeper end. There is a serious deep end of theology going right back to Augustine and others around understanding of sin and naming it. So this is just a little splash around in that deep end of the pool for a moment. This is a summary, I think, of what the Bible and what theology brings. Sin fractures everything it touches. It brings this. It fractures the self with those notions of shame and anxiety and insecurity. Because often we know that that is true of ourselves. One of the most dangerous buttons to push is the challenge of hypocrisy. Because it isn't just in Facebook that we put our best selves forward, our polished versions, the happy snaps of holidays. We do it in church. We do it everywhere. And that's actually just natural. But we know deeper within, if people knew what I was really like, the thoughts of my heart, I would cringe of embarrassment. Sin also fractures relationships by breeding mistrust and blame and self-protection. It damages society, where the oppression of the weak over from the hands of the powerful, of injustice and exploitation, has just been replete throughout history and continues to our present day. In fact, in Romans 8, as we looked at earlier in the year, all creation is suffering under the impact. It is groaning under the impact of sin. So the Bible says that sin is not small. It is not trivial. It is cosmic. And we need to take it seriously. So, one of the books that I found particularly helpful on my shelf was by Cornelius Plantinga, Jr., an American philosopher and theologian, excellent writer. Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, A Breviary of Sin. Just a couple of just quotes, it's a touchy, he's got a lot more to say about it, but a really helpful way. He says, God hates sin not just because it violates the law, but more substantively, because it violates shalom, the way things are meant to be. And because it violates shalom, it breaks the peace it interferes with the way that things are supposed to be. And one final quote from Plantinga: sin hurts other people and it grieves God, but it also corrodes us. Sin is a form of self-abuse. It entangles. It brings bitterness. It brings envy. It brings all those elements that just is destructive. So, I've got one more big quote to come, but that's all. So in that context, in this darkness that we know is true, it's reality, we can't just pretend, the dawn from on high breaks in to bring light into that world and to bring hope, where God says, I can deal with this. I will deal with this. And you're about to see it through my son, Jesus, in the context of Luke's gospel. Jesus will bring the hope in the midst of that broken and fractured and troubled world and provide a light unlike any others. The fullness of the day is not here yet, but the dawn is breaking. So I said one last quote from Augustine of Hippo. Augustine has a very profound insight that sin arises from misdirected or wrongly ordered loves. It's not that the love is wrong in itself, but if we make it the most important love, then it's out of order. If we love ourselves before God, if we love other idols, or if we love other things in creation before God, they're good things, but it's out of order. And we can have lesser goods have elevated as far more important. And we do see a fair bit of that in our world today with all the promotion of stuff that this is what's going to make for purpose in life and all the hopes and dreams. And you realise, actually, those are lesser things compared to the deeper truths. Or things where we prefer created things over the Creator. There's a lot more to Augustine about that. But it's from Augustine that we get the prayer which we did introduce, and Wendy, you're right, I didn't actually put it in the PowerPoint. It might turn up somewhere, I don't know. I'm sure I uploaded it. But the prayer of preparation, that God will speak to the desires of our hearts. That is where it centres. And if there's any true remedy, we have to change the desires of our hearts to start loving what is good and of God. And then we will see change in our life, and then we will see change in our community, and then we'll see change occurring in a broader level. So in that context, let's just sit with this. But you, child, John the Baptist, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give his people knowledge of salvation through the forgiveness of their sins. Amen.